Welcome back to the In Between podcast. I'm your host, Mel Barrett. Here we are,
week 7 of the retrial of Karen Reed. We're well into the defense's case in chief now, and this past week, easily one of the wildest we've seen so far. Let's start with Monday. First thing in the morning, we got Judge Cannone's ruling on those now infamous group chat texts between Trooper Proctor and his buddies. Texts the defense had been fighting hard to get in. And in a rare win, Bev ruled they could be admitted without Proctor having to testify. Here's Bev with her ruling.
Mr. Brennan, I'm letting the text messages in over the Commonwealth's objection. I find that they're properly authenticated. They come in as they go to the state of mind of Trooper Proctor, specifically as that goes to potentially reflecting any bias or omissions in the police investigation. So I'll give a limiting instruction at the time they come in.
Boom. That's legalese for Proctor's shit-talking might show he was never interested in a fair investigation. The texts are bad, like super bad. If you watched the last trial, you heard a lot about these texts and how disgusting they were. So Proctor's childhood bro, Jonathan Diamante, who seems like an above-board dude, took the stand to authenticate these texts. He only had a couple of texts in the thread himself, but most importantly, he reminded us all of how casual cops can be about death. Now, interestingly, the defense introduced the texts, but didn't have Jonathan read them. The prosecution did. Why? Could be strategic, having the Commonwealth read their own guy's crass texts out loud rather than the defense making it a spectacle. But Diamante stood his ground on the stand. He refused to read the most salacious of the texts, forcing Hank Brennan to read them, which made it even more cringy, in my opinion. And here's what we learned. Proctor, in the hours after John's death, thought something shady had gone down at 34 Fairview. One of his friend's texts said, quote, "So the owner of the house was a cop that beat him up?" End quote. Proctor responds, quote, "That's what I initially thought after talking to Canton paramedics," end quote. So even Proctor suspected John had died as a result of a fight. Then they started talking about whether it could have been intentional, and Proctor says, quote, "That's a whole other animal we won't be able to prove," end quote. And yet, despite admitting they can't prove it, he still says, quote, "Zero chance she's skating. She's fucked," end quote. Meaning Karen's going down for this regardless. That's not a cop doing his job. That's a cop starting to, quote unquote, pin it on the girl. Then the conversation just devolves into full-blown misogyny. One of Proctor's friends asks if Karen's hot, at least. Proctor calls her a, quote unquote, "whack job cunt," end quote. Says she's a babe with a, quote, "weird Fall River accent," end quote, and has, quote unquote, "no ass." This is the lead investigator, you guys. It keeps going. He jokes about Karen's colitis and cancer, but the line that stuck with me, really stuck, is when one of the guys asked if Brian Albert was going to catch any heat for having a body turn up on his lawn. And Proctor's response, quote, "nope, homeowners of Boston cop too," end quote. Not, "nope, he wasn't involved," not, "nope, we ruled him out," just, "he's a Boston cop." That's it. That's the reason. That's all it takes to skate. If that's not the blue wall of silence, I don't know what is. And all of this, less than 24 hours after John's body was found. Next up, Officer Kelly Dever. Now, technically, she's a Boston cop, but at the time of John's death, she was working a patrol shift for Canton PD. She was the definition of a hostile witness. That doesn't mean she was angry, although, to be fair, she kind of was angry. But in legal terms, it just means she was called by the defense, even though she clearly aligns more with the prosecution. And you could tell Dever did not want to be there. Her body language was stiff, her answers were clipped, and she kept looking like she wished the floor would just swallow her up whole. Still, the defense had a reason to call her. In an August 2023 interview with federal investigators, she claimed she saw something big. She said she watched surveillance footage of the Canton PD garage, or the Sallyport, and saw ATF agent Brian Higgins and then Canton Police Chief Ken Berkowitz go into the garage alone with Karen's SUV, and that they stayed there for a wildly long time. She said the whole thing was weird because she knew that Brian had been at the party and that he was now in the garage with the biggest piece of evidence in a murder investigation. If that's true, that's huge. That would mean two law enforcement officers, one of whom is a potential suspect in John's death, were alone in a secure location with the primary piece of physical evidence. But when Dever took the stand this week, she said, never mind, false memory. She claimed she'd been shown evidence that she had already left Canton PD before Karen's SUV even got there, and that her entire detailed story, who went in, how long, what she saw, it was just made up, a hallucination. She called it a false memory. Look, I get memory issues. I'm usually searching for my glasses when they're on my head, but this wasn't, oh, I thought that happened on Tuesday, but actually it was a Wednesday. This was a full-on, vivid recollection of an event that, according to her, never happened. And her story changed after she was called into the Boston Police Commissioner's office for a one-on-one. Dever was a rookie at the time and didn't think it was odd that the commish called her in for a special meeting. Here's Dever explaining what the commissioner told her in that meeting.
I had a conversation, but it was my department saying, regardless of what I need to say on the stand, they support me.
Did you find it unusual that a rookie police officer would be called up to the commissioner's office personally to discuss a matter?
It was a reflection of how good of a leader he is. It was not anything that I found unusual, given the fact he is someone who wanted to show support for his officer.
And who else was in that office?
Me. And him. The two of us.
General counsel for the Boston Police Department?
No, it's just me and him.
The commissioner say to you that Boston Police Department, insofar as your connection to this case is concerned, Boston Police Department fully supports you.
Yes.
Did he also say, do the right thing?
That's a direct quote, so I can't recollect if he said a direct quote 2 years ago.
A year ago, when you talk to us, the defense, did you tell the defense that when you were called up to the commissioner's office, we told you two things? Commissioner Cox told you, number one, the Boston Police Department supports you, and Officer Dever, do the right thing.
So he said my name correctly. He said Dever. And
that's my mistake. Let's see. You want me to repeat the question so I get
so
that right?
Mr. Jackson, let's go ahead and answer, please.
Yes, and he said nothing with the intent of guiding me one way or the other.
I asked you what his intent was, madam. I asked you what he said to you. What were his words to you?
That he supports me.
And?
Just wanted me to tell the truth up here.
And his words were, do the right thing, right?
I don't recall.
And just to reiterate, she claimed she had a false memory after this meeting in which the commish told her to, quote unquote, do the right thing. She also transferred out of Canton PD to Boston and received a raise from just over $30,000 a year to over $140,000 a year. She was born and raised in Canton and from all accounts sounded like she was doing the right thing when the feds interviewed her. But then that thin blue line got to her, and now she's one of the boys, in my humble opinion. Something isn't tracking here, and it smells worse than the Boston Harbor in the dead of summer. Dever also claimed the defense threatened her with perjury if she didn't stick to her original story. The defense can't actually charge anyone with anything. They're not cops. But I don't doubt that they may have said the word. Is it aggressive? Sure. Is it a worse look than a cop giving a detailed interview to federal investigators and then completely recanting it after getting called into the Boston Police Commissioner's office? You tell me. Let's take a quick break and we'll get back to the next witness for the defense, Dr. Marie Russell, the dog bite expert.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Welcome back, and thanks for listening to the ads in this episode. It keeps us moving forward, and I really appreciate you. Up next on the stand is Dr. Russell, who is an ER doc, a forensic pathologist, a former prison medical officer, a professor, and wait for it, an actual cop. The first woman cop from Malden, Massachusetts in 1977. She was in med school while serving 7 years as a cop. She's seen over 500 dog bite cases, and she's done more autopsies than most people have watched episodes of Law & Order. Her take? John's arm injuries were consistent with dog bites. Highly specific, she said. She described a pattern of wounds and defensive positioning that, in her opinion, pointed to an animal attack. She even pointed to that hole in John's hoodie, the one near the elbow with frayed edges, and said, quote, "that was made by a canine tooth," end quote. She also said the wounds happened before John died. They showed inflammation, a vital reaction that only happens while someone's alive. But Brennan came out swinging on Cross. He pushed her on her credentials, her prior testimony, even on whether she had memory issues when she couldn't remember which assistant helped format her report. It felt like a cheap shot, ageist, snarky, unnecessary. And the jury noticed. You could feel the room shift, and Dr. Russell literally gasped. Here's that moment.
You have any memory issues?
No.
Still, Brennan scored a few hits. He got her to admit that the hoodie didn't test positive for dog DNA, though it did contain pig DNA, which she said could have come from a dog treat. And yeah, she didn't mention quote-unquote dog bites specifically in her first testimony during the original trial, but she says she's done more research since then. She didn't flip-flop from car crash to dog attack. She went from animal injury to, yep, definitely dog. Big difference. The next witness was Sergeant Nicholas Barrows from Dighton PD. Dighton is where Karen's parents live. It's where Proctor and Buchanick showed up to question Karen and have the Lexus towed. Barrows was called in to help facilitate since he was a local cop. Barrows was actually a prosecution witness in the first trial. This time, he took the stand for the defense and dropped a bomb. He testified that when the tow came for the Lexus, there was only a small piece missing from the taillight, about the size of a dollar bill. But when Jackson showed him a photo of the taillight after it arrived at Canton PD, Barrows said,
"Sergeant Barrows, is this the condition of the right rear taillight when you showed up at the Reese Reed household at around 3:15 in the afternoon on January 29th, 2022?
Absolutely not.
What's different about this photo, sir?
That taillight is completely smashed out."
Keep in mind, Barrows has nothing to gain here. He's still an active cop in a town less than 30 miles away from Canton. If anything, he's risking a lot by speaking out, and that gives him credibility. Now, Brennan tried to ding him on Cross. He pointed out that Barrows never wrote down the dollar bill description in his original report. Also, that he didn't actually see anyone tamper with the taillight, but that's not really the point. The point is that something changed between the car leaving the driveway and arriving at the station, and now a cop is saying it under oath. Keep in mind, Michael Proctor also lied on every report filed that the Lexus was towed over an hour earlier than it actually was. So what happened during that hour plus? Barrows is one of those good cops trying to do the right thing. He could teach Kelly Deborah a thing or two. Up next, Brian Lucky Loughran. He's a jack of all trades, a snowplow driver, a Zamboni operator, a delivery guy, and a widow. He's also known the Alberts brothers since they were kids. He testified that during his plow route, in the early morning hours of John's death, he passed 34 Fairview multiple times. Each time, he had a clear view of the lawn and flagpole area all the way up to the front door. And what did he see? Nothing. Nobody. But on one of his last loops, something did change. There was a Ford Edge parked in the street. Unusual because it's against the rules during a snow emergency, and the Alberts typically parked in their driveway. But Lucky didn't report it because, well, he knew Brian Albert was a cop, so he gave him a pass. Brennan tried to paint Lucky as influenced or threatened by Turtle Boy's coverage. Brennan didn't actually invoke Turtle Boy's name or moniker, but he mentioned a well-known blogger threatening him. Lucky assured the Commonwealth and the jury that he never felt threatened. And Lucky's initial statement about not seeing a body on the lawn that he made to the defense's private investigator came before Turtle Boy even wrote about him.
"Any time from when you first spoke to the private investigator until today, were there communications made to you by an online blogger that there would be consequence for you if you didn't testify in a way that was acceptable to them?"
"No."
"You listened, of course, didn't you, to podcasts that were about you?"
"I did not."
"People told you about them?"
"Yes, they did."
"When friends told you about them, you knew who that person was that was making those claims, correct?"
"Correct."
"You were well aware of the person had a very strong and large social media presence?"
"I didn't know how large or what his presence were, but yes, I knew he had a blog."
"Well, you know now because you follow that blogger now, don't you?"
"I do follow him, yes."
"Do you pay for a subscription?"
"I do not."
"Did you get one for free?"
"I did not."
"And in following that blogger, you know full well the power that person has to get attention from the community to harass, correct?"
"Yes."
"And so during the pendency of this case, not only were you aware that you were being pressured to testify a certain way, you also knew there'd be consequences if you didn't. Isn't that true?
Objection.
I'm going to allow that.
The premise of that question is not accurate.
So he can answer it.
You knew there was pressure for you to testify a certain way in this case, didn't you?
I did not know I was being required to testify a certain way. I was also at the time dealing with the loss of my wife. I was not paying any attention to any social media.
Lucky's testimony matters, not just because of what he saw or didn't see, but because of who he is. He's the kind of guy jurors trust. He works hard, speaks plainly, and he put his name on the record, even though it meant going up against the most powerful family in his hometown. That takes guts. And finally, we got to Dr. Daniel Wolf, accident reconstruction expert from ARCA. Dimples, if you will. Wolf ran multiple tests at different speeds with different angles using crash test dummies and arms, and said the damage on Karen's car was not consistent with hitting a human being. Not the taillight, not the hoodie tears, not the impact pattern, nothing lined up. He ran experiments at 10, 17, 24, and 29 miles per hour just to hammer the point home. What I saw? In every experiment at every speed, John's arm would have been broken or dislocated at the very least. And John had no broken bones. On Brennan's cross, he came out swinging like we knew he would. He was in jerk mode and didn't hold back. He grilled Wolf on everything from dummy arm weight to message deletions to Signal app use. Wolf admitted to deleting messages and giving the defense a list of suggested questions. Not great optics, but not a smoking gun either. And if the Commonwealth had brought ARCA on when the feds offered them up, like the defense did, Wolf said he would have done the same for them. And even though they ran new tests to show why the prosecution's theory of the case was wrong through their expert Welcher, Wolf has the same conclusions he had in the first trial. The damage of Karen's car isn't consistent with hitting John O'Keefe. And if that holds, it's another brick in the defense's wall of reasonable doubt. The defense's case continues next week, and Mel from the future can tell you, you don't want to miss the chaos that happens in week 8 of this trial. Hold on to your butts. We're starting to wrap this up. See you next week, and don't forget, be good people. Don't do murder.
The In Between podcast is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett, and is a production of Ruby Grace Productions. If you want ad-free exclusive content, bonuses, and lives, head on over to the In Between podcast Patreon and sign up. The researcher level starts at $6, and there's already 20-plus ad-free episodes for you to binge right now. Special thanks to Amber Hunt for editorial guidance, as well as the rest of the team at Grab Bag Collab, Amanda Rossman, and Daisy Egan, for their support and guidance. Another special thanks to Rebecca Lavoie for her friendship and mentorship. You can catch me and Rebecca recapping the Karen Reed trial on the Crime Writers On, The Readathon. Follow the In Between podcast on Blue Sky, Facebook, and YouTube at In Between Pod, and on Instagram at The In Between Pod Official. On TikTok, you can follow me at Jack of All Trades DC. Thanks for listening.